This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, the SNC-Lavalin affair. We'll speak with Ontario Conservative MP Michael Barrett. Support is building for a monument commemorating the number 26 explosion. We'll hear about the debate on EHS services that hit the legislature's health committee and an update on the Atlantic Park project. All coming up in Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. The SNC-Lavalin affair continues to dominate the federal political scene. The House of Commons Justice Committee investigating claims by former Justice Minister Jody Wilson-Raybould. She says she was pressured by the Prime Minister's office to help the Quebec Engineering Company avoid criminal prosecution. Trudeau government continues to say she didn't face any undue pressure. Opposition MPs on the Justice Committee want her to come back to testify for a second time. Ontario Conservative Michael Barrett sits on that committee. He spoke with Dialogue's Bobby Nock.
The meeting was, we were 24 minutes into the meeting, and a Liberal member of the committee moved that the meeting be adjourned, and the Liberal-dominated committee voted in favor, and the opposition members voted against, and the meeting was adjourned.
And what's been your party's reaction to that?
Well, we see this as a continuation of Justin Trudeau using his majority to cover up his involvement in this corruption scandal, and it started when we asked for an inquiry into the scandal, and the Liberals voted against having a public inquiry. We asked for the Prime Minister to appear before the committee. They voted against him appearing. And the only time they let witnesses appear before the committee is when they believe that the narrative will be beneficial to their story. And now that Ms. Wilson-Raybould would have the opportunity to rebut what's been said about her and has been said about areas that she is forbidden to speak about, they won't let her return, and they will only hold the next meeting in behind closed doors, so no media, no public allowed, and they're going to do it on budget day. So we can. Their hope is that this story will be buried beneath the federal budget.
And the next meeting, will you be still discussing the SNC-Lavalin matter? Is that what
we will? Yes. So the purpose of the meeting will be to continue to discuss this study that we've undertaken. But, you know, based on the Liberal member who moved the motion to adjourn, the member for Glengarry, Prescott Russell, he's a Liberal, Mr. Druin, he's saying today that he's heard enough from Ms. Wilson-Raybould, and now it's time to move on to other things, like looking to separate the role of Attorney General and a Justice Minister, and that's a channel change effort by them. But it does telegraph what we can expect behind closed doors next week. And really, you know, to use their majority to just crush an attempt at transparency by the opposition, which is, and this issue is clearly in the public interest, it's disgusting. This is a government that's in absolute chaos, and their prime minister is half-timing it in Florida. He's been flying back and forth to Florida. And meanwhile, we have the OECD concerned about us breaking our international obligations surrounding bribery of foreign public officials. We've got major concerns that Canadians have in their public institutions, and silence from the Prime Minister and their committee doesn't want to hear what Ms. Wilson-Raybould has to say, and they need to let her speak.
Well, what more light do you think Ms. Wilson-Raybould can shed on this by having her back? What do you hope to learn?
The truth. And when she said that she wasn't able to, finish her testimony, we believe it's incumbent on the committee to conduct a full study, as is its mandate, and to hear her full testimony. Mr. Butts was satisfied that he testified fully. Mr. Wernick was satisfied that he testified fully, as was Ms. Druin. And Ms. Wilson-Raybould said while testifying that she couldn't give her full testimony. And we didn't know, the conservative members of that committee, we had no idea what Ms. Wilson-Raybould was going to say, but we expect that all witnesses will tell the truth when they are there. And she's a member of the Liberal caucus. So it would be reasonable for one to assume that she could come and say things that would be unhelpful to what we were doing. But she wasn't there in a partisan effort. She was there to tell the truth. And we are after one thing and one thing only, and that's the truth. And, you know, that's the difference between people have compared this to the Watergate scandal with Richard Nixon. And the difference, the big difference between firing of special prosecutors and attorneys general in the U.S. and here is that the party that the then president was a part of, they supported an investigation to get to the truth. But here we have an attorney general fired for standing up for what's right. And the Liberals are circling the wagons and protecting the Prime Minister. That's very troubling.
Now, the Prime Minister's former Principal Secretary and a Glace Bay native, Gerald Butts, testified. Did he tell the truth?
As I said, my expectation is that everyone that appears before committee tells the truth. But what I can say is that there are discrepancies between Ms. Wilson-Raybould's testimony and Mr. Butts' testimony. And those discrepancies need to be addressed. And I think that the next most appropriate person to speak to about those is Ms. Wilson-Raybould. She needs to respond to some of the things that Mr. Butts said. And that challenge needs to be taken up. And at that point, then people can make an assessment. And we're not going to have a finding of guilt or pass a judgment at this committee, but we will issue a report at the end of it. But we do believe that a public inquiry would have been prudent for the government to allow that, but they voted against it. And that's a nonpartisan effort, a public inquiry. And we hope that having received a letter from the leader of Her Majesty's Loyal Opposition, Andrew Scheer, that the RCMP has undertaken to review if a criminal investigation is warranted. And if so, we hope that that's done in an expeditious manner. But really, I think that the next most appropriate thing that can be done based on the framework that we're operating inside is that the Liberals allow Ms. Wilson-Raybould to speak fully of her time in cabinet, both as Veterans Minister and as Minister of Justice and Attorney General.
Well, what are some of the discrepancies between Ms. Wilson-Raybould's testimony and Mr. Butts' testimony that you would like, Ms. Wilson-Raybould to clarify?
I mean, the issues around certainly conversations that were had and the conversations that were had. I mean, we've also asked for more witnesses to come, including chiefs of staff, to the finance minister, chief of staff, to the former attorney general, staff from the prime minister's office, and the characterizations made of conversations had between the former principal secretary and the former attorney general's chief of staff. There's a big gap between what's being reported by Ms. Wilson-Raybould and what's being reported by Mr. Butts, as one example. And so we have asked multiple times for those witnesses to appear, and the witness list speaks for itself. Currently, the Liberals have no desire to call further witnesses, but we will discuss whether or not further witnesses can be called at a closed-door meeting on Tuesday morning. And so so examples like that are, I think, it would be very prudent, and we've asked for the production of documents, and the Liberal members of the committee have refused our request to have documents tabled. And so we would like supporting documents from Mr. Butts. We'd like supporting documents from Ms. Wilson-Raybould. But again, the order in council is limiting our ability to get the full picture of what happened.
Now Ms. Wilson-Raybould has testified that she was pressured or felt unduly pressured to have SNC-Lavalin avoid a criminal prosecution, and Mr. Butts has testified that she wasn't unduly pressured. I mean, that's the discrepancy, I guess. But I don't understand how having Ms. Wilson-Bold come back would help clear that up. I mean, you know, Mr. Butts is saying one thing and Ms. Wilson-Raybould is saying another.
She's saying part of another thing. And what we've seen here is the Prime Minister speaks freely about whatever period of time before, during, or after Ms. Wilson-Raybould was the Attorney General and the Minister of Veterans Affairs. And Mr. Butts spoke freely about the time before, during, and after. And the Clerk of the Privy Council spoke freely about the time before, during, and after. Ms. Wilson-Raybould is operating under a very narrow permission given by an order in council about what she's able to speak about. Now, the gentleman that I just mentioned, they have no fear being allied with the Prime Minister, that the Prime Minister, the Prime Minister's office, or that the government will pursue them for telling tales out of school, so to speak. But I think Ms. Wilson-Raybould is right to exercise caution, and she has very able legal counsel who is advising her, a former justice, and she is, I think, is well advised to be cautious. And I mean, if there's nothing to hide, I'm unsure why the Prime Minister wouldn't just allow her to speak freely about the issue.
Well, speaking of the Prime Minister, when he talks about this, he talks about the 9,000 jobs at SNC-Lavalin and his interest in protecting those jobs. If the Conservatives were in government, would you not take steps to protect those jobs as well? How would you respond to this situation differently?
Well, for one thing, you don't need to bend or break the rules to protect jobs. That's I think that's the first thing. And the second thing is, there has been no evidence presented, and no evidence presented in response to our requests as to how any jobs were put in jeopardy by a criminal prosecution. So a criminal prosecution is now underway. So this is going to go ahead. A deferred prosecution agreement has not been granted to the company. And I haven't heard about any mass layoffs, and I haven't heard about all of the projects that SNC has been given. There are from coast to coast to coast, SNC is working on municipal, provincial, and federal contracts and private sector contracts. They've got $1 billion in backordered work, and they have a covenant in an agreement with the Caisse de dépôt in Quebec that they're going to operate a fully staffed headquarters there until at least 2027. And the CEO, following his knowledge of a deferred prosecution agreement not being granted of SNC, has said, we're in Canada to stay. So the argument that any jobs were in peril is without any evidence that has been presented. And we've asked all of the players what risk there were to these jobs, and none has been presented. But what's more is the government has the ability to, and they're examining it right now, to change the regulations. So they wanted to go one way and exercise a deferred prosecution agreement. Well, the independent director of public prosecutions said no. The only person who can override that decision is the Attorney General. She said no. Okay, that should be case closed, and they should respect that. But the government also, it's its own rules. It's not a criminal judge. It's not a court judgment that would prevent SNC from bidding on federal contracts for 10 years. That's a procurement rule with the federal government, and they're currently looking to change that rule. So the merits of what the procurement rules are and the merits of deferred prosecution agreements, those are a red herring. What we're talking about and what we're very interested in is a government that has undertaken a cover-up to very, very troubling behavior. And at first, the Prime Minister's story was, nothing happened. And then it was, he said there was no pressure and no influence. Then there wasn't undue pressure. And then he said, well, there was pressure, but it was the right amount of pressure. And so his story has shifted like the wind, and we don't need a shifting narrative from the PMO. We need the truth, and Canadians deserve that.
How much of a political opportunity is this for the Conservative Party in this federal election year?
I think that it's a great opportunity for Canadians to have been presented with a government who offered openness and transparency in 2015, and they were going to do government differently, and there was going to be sunny ways, and were hyper critical of the former government, and one thing after another, ethics commissioner investigation, and finding of guilt in those ethics commissioner investigations, and repeat, now we're in this huge scandal with international implications. I think it's a tremendous opportunity for Canadians to see this Liberal government for what it is, and I think that our leader Andrew Scheer has been very clear and has been very reasonable and is a credible and is the right alternative to Justin Trudeau. And we are focused on responsible fiscal management. We're focused on Canadians getting ahead, and we won't be mired in scandal like this Liberal government.
Code critical. No ambulances available. It's scary stuff, but it's been happening in the province and in particular in Cape Breton, and the province's paramedics have been taking the government to task. At the Standing Committee on Health session, a chance for opposition MLAs to ask some questions. Appearing before the committee, Deputy Health Minister Denise Barrette, Director of Provincial Operations for EHS Jeff Fraser, Union Business Manager Terry Chapman, and Chief Operating Officer for Emergency Medical Paula Poirier. Here's an excerpt from that session as Cape Breton Centre NDP MLA Tammy Martin asks the questions.
Thank you so much, and thank you, everyone, for being here. I'll start with my questions to Mike and Terry, and as from one union leader to another, I'm so happy that you are getting a voice to your concerns. So thank you for being here. A few things I'd just like to clarify from your last remarks, and I believe it was you, Terry, that said paramedics pay 100% of your medical. So as a former NSHA employee, we paid $65.35. So are you saying that there's no co-pay from your employer?
Mr. Chapman.
Not right now. But as I made comment, we do intend to, when it becomes an official comment to the employer, inform the employer that we will be looking perhaps for some bridge program or other program where that's no longer the case.
So you're, sorry, Mike?
Mr. Nickerson.
Just to add to that, the 100% pay is for short-term and long-term. The medical plan is paid for by the employer.
Okay. Okay, thanks for clarifying that. And I believe, Terry, also you talked about, and I completely agree, we don't want to privatize any service, but in my years in the Cape Breton District Health Authority, we had PTUs, which is called patient transfer units. Are they still out there for the non-emergent transfers?
Yes.
Do they ever get used for, or my understanding is sometimes when we are at a code critical point, they are used for other than just transfers?
I think if you want the details or the specifics of that and how they're allocated, when there is the requirement, I think that Mr. Fraser would best answer that.
Okay.
Mr. Fraser.
Thanks for the question. So we have, in our two cities in the province, we have what I would refer to as a split production model. And that is, we have emergency ambulances in Halifax region, and we have emergency ambulances obviously in Cape Breton, but we also have these transfer units that you suggested. For the most part, the transfer work that we do is very predictable. We usually know by 4 o'clock today what our volumes are going to look like tomorrow, and allocating those crews to those vehicles which are not part of our emergency deployment plan allows us to move those patients freely between the hospitals. There are occasions, because some of the units we have are multi-patient transfer units, and they have the ability to transport two patients at one time. So we like to use those units if we have a major event where we're able to move the ambulances to. But for the most part, we have a split production model, and it is separate. And we do that on purpose so we can take some pressure off the emergency system.
Okay. Thank you. So, and back to Terry and or Mike, do you see this code critical as just one result or one systemic issue as a result of the overall healthcare crisis in this province?
I think we understand it as everyone else sees it. Everyone sees that who speak with us, the people who see the code critical issue see it as the issue that might affect them. And perhaps it could be a fair statement to say that not everyone understands the intricacy of the models that need to be refined to cure it. And it's easy to stand outside of the fence and look in and see all of the animals, but it's different than going in and being one of the animals. And we are but one of the animals in the farmyard, mm-hmm. with all of the other ones, no disrespect, that all need to play together and play nicely and think and learn the program together and then come to a solution to it.
So to that end, I would suggest then that on one of my last tours of the regional hospital ER in Sydney, when there were 27 admits and numerous patients waiting for transfer to a long-term care bed and 5 ambulances lined up in the bay, that had we had a significant investment in long-term care beds, then that would move the process through. Because when there's a stall and you can't get patients moving, we can't get our ambulances in and out of the system.
I think that the question of long-term care beds and whatever facilities might be constructed to put those in, that in any way that you can take the load from the ER and get it out of there so that there are available beds in the ER. Absolutely. For our members to leave a patient behind and again get back to the street, I think anything that would fix that would be at least a partial cure to it, whether it's long-term care beds or not. And if long-term care beds, and again, Michael and I not being the authority in that or the principal for that, if that's a way to fix it, and it will be fixed, then I'm good for anything that anybody can come up with fixing it.
So how long typically does it take to get an ambulance?
That depends on the day, and all I can tell you is because we don't see the daily CAD stats, we don't actually get that printed into the day that shows where they're muddled. We have a different procedure. But when in 1997, when the performance-based contract was devised, there was a township requirement of 8 minutes, 59 seconds from the time you pick up the phone and actually talk to someone until the ambulance is knocking at your door. Now, that could be in cases that we actually have seen, and one case that I actually witnessed was in this city was 58 minutes.
Is that acceptable?
To me, it's not.
So, being from Cape Breton, I have known many instances where there has been zero ambulances available in CBRM. I also know that sometimes the nearest ambulance is in Bedeck and or Antigonish. If that was my family member who needed an ambulance, let me tell you, you'd hear me screaming from the rooftops. So what happens when I call an ambulance, God forbid, in New Waterford, and the nearest ambulance is in Bedeck?
You wait.
So my loved one has just had a cardiac arrest.
You wait with a person who will be probably non-living when they arrive.
And how that doesn't infuriate the people of this house boggles my mind each and every day.
I agree with you.
Do you see any other statistics that would be benefit or a beneficial to post or publish, as you know, as with the code critical.
One thing that we're very cautious of is we fully intended to make the public aware every time that we can be aware when there is what we call a code critical issue. And one of the reasons, just to go back a little bit, is when we met with Minister DeLore a little over a year ago, when this was becoming the issue, we shared with them that we would like to see something started. We'd like to see some movement in somehow to alleviate this problem. And failing that, we would have to have the public help us do that, people who pay taxes do that. And that's actually what started the Code Critical, is to make the people who pay taxes aware of the probability that there may not be an ambulance when they need one. And by the way, 1,000 of our members pay taxes.
Absolutely. I'm sorry, I'm still upset by your previous answer. The John Ross report in 2010 said that the average, or that the standard patient should wait is 20 minutes. How often is this happening?
I can't give you a brass number on how often it happens because, again, we don't see the CAD at minute by minute. But based on the fact that on any given day in this city, there is one available ambulance, I would bet dollars to donuts that it's not very often.
Are the offload times different at different facilities, different hospitals across the province?
Yes.
And why would that be? Is there a reason why certain places are having more of a difficult time to meet that standard or to even show up within a reasonable amount of time?
Well, one of the things I became aware of at a meeting with the minister, I believe it was on the 8th, was I wasn't actually aware until that meeting, because there were other stakeholders, actually people from the Dartmouth General Hospital were there, and they made me aware of the differences between taking from core staff to facilitate a program and having to otherwise administrate staff, take them in, similar to us moving trucks around inside of the hospital. So I can't answer what would fix it or what the reason in each place is, but each hospital that experiences this, experiences it, to my knowledge, and our experience, that it's never a schedule. You can't say that 9 o'clock this morning it's going to be the QE2, but at 11 it's going to be the Truro, Colchester Regional Hospital. It's random, sporadic, but it does happen every day somewhere.
And you mentioned the lack of, shortage. A quick fix would be more ambulances and more paramedics. And this government tells us, you know, or has told us in this House that they're investing in. But we believe as well that that's not the long-term fix. I've had conversations with Mike about paramedics fleeing Nova Scotia because they're like other healthcare workers in this province right now. They're exhausted.
That's true.
We have, you know, I talked to many from a cleaner to a doctor and everybody in between, including paramedics, that are exhausted and are not being listened to. Do you have any hope or belief that there's going to be a remedy anytime soon so that you can get back to your families, so that the nurses who don't get a chance, and I quote, get to go to the bathroom on a 12-hour shift, that this will change anytime soon?
I'm hopeful that seeing what's happening today and in the past few weeks with Minister DeLore and his folks and the Department of Health and EMC Medical Care Incorporated, I'm hopeful that this is the point where we're going to start to see what we would call a corrective resolution to the problem. But I can also see, as was in several years ago, I can also see people who might otherwise have stayed not wanting to be a paramedic anymore and going to other provinces. And when it happens, I've actually jokingly predicted it's going to be June or July of this year, without them actually telling it, because we see patterns. When it happens, it's going to happen. And when one leaves, the people who see the green grass are going to leave with them.
Thank you. So perhaps going back to Mr. Fraser, do you know how many times an emergency vehicle is used as a PTU?
Mr. Frazier.
Thank you for your question. Part of the current system design that is in place, you know, some of those patient movements are utilized by our emergency ambulances. That's the system design that we've been operating on for a number of years here in the province. And it's also one of the reasons that we're very thankful the department has brought Fitch and Associates in. As an operator of the system, obviously we see opportunities to make some major changes. Fitch will help articulate that and help with some of the blind spots in the way that our service operates. So we do recognize this is a great opportunity as we go forward, but ambulances do patient transfers. That is how the system has been designed. We, in our busier areas, as I mentioned earlier, we do our best to split that volume out. Those hospitals are close, and that's why we have that service in place. But if you're in a smaller area, you may be assigned a transfer, but it's important to understand that we are moving our system around, as Ms. Poirier stated earlier, all the time.
So in the last month, you wouldn't know how many times a PTU has been used as an emergency vehicle?
How many times a PTU has been used as an emergency vehicle? I wouldn't have that stat here today. I'm sorry.
No. Okay. So to Ms. Poirier, if I could, in your opening remarks, you mentioned strategies and solutions are being developed for the not-too-distant future. I wonder if you could explain and give us some details on these solutions.
Ms. Poirier.
Sure. Thank you for your question. We have been having discussions, obviously, with the Nova Scotia Health Authority. As you know, from us, from an emergency care perspective, by the time we get to the hospital and the paramedics are standing there, then, you know, obviously we're having to collaborate and what are some of the solutions could be moving forward. Because at the end of the day, if we can move our paramedics out of there 20 minutes or less, it certainly would make a huge difference for us within the system. As far as strategies and opportunities, you know, I'm going to actually pass it over to Mr. Guest, because obviously they will be the ones that will be leading it. We will be obviously helping out.
Mr. Guest.
Thank you for the opportunity to provide some information on some of the work we're doing. I'll give you maybe the easier way to respond to is to give you a couple of examples of some of the things that are underway. At the Dartmouth General Hospital, as an example, we've implemented a team that takes handover of the patients when the ambulance comes in to allow them to offload and return to the community. It was initially done as a pilot, and it has been really very successful. And so we are expanding that to the Turo site. We're expanding that to the Valley Regional site in Kentville. It's just started to be operationalized. We've also put in place rapid assessment zones in a couple of sites. Initially, it was put in Valley Regional, and a rapid assessment zone is an area of the emergency department that you move the individual around depending what's going on. So if they are waiting for lab or diagnostic imaging results, they may wait in a waiting area, and then so they don't hold a stretcher up the entire time so that you can get more people through in care. And so we also have one of those at the Halifax Infirmary, and we're expanding it to 24 hours a day to help with our offload issue at the Halifax Infirmary. There's also a rapid assessment zone we're planning for the Turo site as an example. We've also implemented triage protocols where nurses, when individuals come and assess them, can automatically order lab and DI tests right from triage to help with the timeline and timeliness to care so that when the physician sees them, the results are already back. I think it's important to say that these strategies are very much focused on the emergency department and that they won't solve this issue on their own. And that there's a need to focus on reducing the number of individuals that we're caring for in acute care hospitals that would be better cared for in other settings. And so we're working closely with colleagues in long-term care and home care, and also with the Department of Health and the Department of Community Services to improve our processes so that we can maximize as many opportunities as we can for those individuals to be cared for in more appropriate settings. I think the reality of this is it's going to require a systemic solution to a very complex problem that can't be solved by the ambulance provider or the emergency departments alone.
Thank you for that. We know that transferring patients is an issue. Moving patients through the system is a problem, and it's been mentioned and in the accreditation report. We've heard it from patients, and we've heard it from doctors. We know that the emergency rooms are backed up, so I'd like to talk to Ms. Perrette about how we can address this issue. Can you tell us, please, about the home first philosophy and how it's applied in emergency rooms? And would it be fair to say that there are many individuals in ALC who would not be able to go home, who need to go to direct care or residential care facilities that cannot leave the hospital otherwise?
Ms. Perrette.
So it's an important question, and I think the issue of the movement of patients throughout the system is obviously very complex. If it were simpler, we would have resolved that in this province, and we would resolve it in every other province that is wrestling with it. So what we've been looking at are what are the factors that affect the movement of patients, and what are sort of the levers that we can pull that relieve those pressure points and facilitate the proper care. And there are a number of them. So I know you've mentioned a few, but I don't want anyone to leave. But if it was as simple as having more long-term care beds, then that would have fixed the system decades ago.
The Atlantic Memorial Park Project is getting ready to break ground this summer. Donnie Antle spoke with Atlantic Park Project Director Brian Ferguson about the first phase of the Sydney Mines Memorial Park.
It is. It's covering the construction, the restoration of the command post of the Chapel Point Battery Fortification. And it will include restoring that building, but also include an engineered trail leading up from Lloyd's Cove to the site, appropriate fencing, signage, and a welcome center and washroom. So it's a fairly extensive first phase.
Okay, and you're looking for, you figure there's going to be somebody that's going to get that contract by the end of March, is that correct?
That's correct. The tender went out just recently, as you noted, and the closing date, I think, is March 23rd. And we hope to get the tender issued, the contract issued by the end of the month.
Okay, so then construction starts, well, it would be pretty much right away because that's quite a lot of work to do. And if I understand correctly, you're kind of hoping that that phase will be completed by September?
That's correct. So I would imagine the winning firm will want to get at it as soon as possible in order to meet that deadline.
Okay, now, let's sort of break down what this phase is. So first of all, you talk about restoring the command post. Now, is this just cleaning up and stabilizing what's there now, or will there be restoring it to the way it was when it was operational?
Exactly. The idea is to have it look exactly as it did when it was operational. So that would mean making any concrete repairs, fixing a few beams, cleaning it in terms of getting rid of the graffiti and putting in a stairway up to the fourth level so people can walk up and get an excellent view of the harbor. So it'll be quite a nice result.
Okay. And now are you going to be putting machines into, because I know that was where the machine shop was sort of in the back of the operation post or the observation
post.
Yeah,
we have about a year. We have a couple of areas we're focusing on. One is we have to get this completed, the restoration by September, and hopefully the whole restoration by December. And our next target is to have it open for operations next year, 2020. And so that will be part of our operational planning to get ready for 2020, to find the appropriate furniture and equipment that would go into the command post.
Okay, so you're not going to do the same thing that Fort Petrie did, where Petrie's got sort of like a museum exhibit in that former machine shop space.
Yeah, we haven't decided just exactly what it'll look like in there, but that'll be part of our planning for the opening. So I wouldn't say no. We definitely would like to make it as interesting as possible for people.
Now, another part of the phase that sort of struck me is you're going to be putting in a welcome center.
That's right, a welcome center with washrooms. And that'll be a welcome center, so that people can get tickets to go in and also to obtain brochures and get information from tour guides and the like.
So there will be tour guides on site. That's sort of a plan.
Like, yeah, part of the visitor experience will be that, well, it's going to be quite an amazing experience, really. We will have bilingual tour guides, probably some students and other volunteers trained as tour guides. We will have storytelling sessions at the site, probably in a prearranged program that where we get volunteer storytellers and others who can bring alive the whole idea of the Battle of the Atlantic and what went on at that in that site. And behind the protective fencing, there will be a huge area where people can walk in with sandwiches, have a picnic, look at the harbor, and so it'll be really a family-oriented site.
Okay, and so this is all due to be completed in September, December?
September for the command post itself, but we're going to be having fencing, signage, the welcome center, and signage, welcome center, and fencing, all of that done by December.
Okay. Now, we had spoken before about you'd found pioneer graves on the site. Has there been any movement on maybe putting up a way to mark that space? Or
exactly, Donnie. We will be marking that space so that out of respect, and probably put up a signage there that will explain where the cemetery is and as much information as we can about the people that are buried there.
Okay. So now, what's the phase after that? After we've restored the command post, we've got a new welcome center and the trails and the signage. What is phase two going to look like?
Phase two is the creation of a Mi'kmaq encampment directly below the Chapel Point Battery, and that would be the next phase. And we're working closely with Member Two on that. To develop a plan for that.
Okay, and do we have a timeline for when we can expect to see that phase completed?
No, but we'd like to have a plan done this year so that we could seek appropriate funding and begin work probably as early as next year. That would be our ideal target. So we're working in parallel on that, and some of the concepts around that are quite exciting, like having a feature teepee facing the harbor and all kinds of cultural and traditional information about the Mi'kmaq experience.
And now I want to ask you, because I know one of the final phases, or the final phase, was going to be sort of a memorial to the Battle of the Atlantic. Now, you had some discussions with the fellow who was behind the Mother Canada initiative to create a war memorial along the Cabot Trail. How did those discussions unfold, and is he on board?
Well, I'll tell you, there's an article in the newspaper just the other day with a headline that left the wrong impression about communications that we had with Mr. Trigiani. Mm-hmm. We've had some early communications with him to see if he would be interested in visiting the site. He's clarified all along that his intention is to continue to seek to have the memorial at Green Cove. And so there have been no discussions about the possibility of him changing his mind in that regard. So, but in actual fact, I'd like to also emphasize that what we have in mind is a much bigger concept in a huge area, 120 acres, in a place where the real history of the war occurred. So in addition to the Mi'kmaq encampment, we'll have that phase. Phase four will include an archer remembrance at the park entrance up at where the former mine site was, displaying the coats of arms of Canada's provinces and territories, a modern visitor education center containing the latest methods for displaying and communicating information, provincial books of sacrifice so that individuals from all over the country can view the fallen from their area, memorials to Canada's overseas military sacrifices and the historic Sydney Harbour contributions to the military, and a feature monument, which is what you were referring to, facing Vimy, and a replica of Vimy Battlefield. So the richness of this site far surpasses the discussion about a specific monument.
February 24th, 1979 is a date that will never be forgotten by coal miners and their families in Glace Bay and Cape Breton. It was the day when 12 men were killed in an explosion at number 26 Colliery. Now, the daughter of one of the miners who died in the blast is part of a group that's trying to gather support for the building of a monument. We spoke with Joanne Shepherd to find out more about the project.
You want to build a monument to remember the men who died in the number 26 mine. How did this proposal come about?
Well, a couple of years ago, I felt that it was time to consider putting some kind of a monument in place for these men. It just seemed like there was never anything that was openly public where people could just go and pay respects and contemplate on the history of what took place in Glace Bay and surrounding areas in 1979. That explosion affected a lot of families, a lot of people, and I've often come across people who, you know, would openly talk about how they were affected by it. They had an uncle or they had a brother or their father went down to rescue those men. So it's a big part of Glace Bay and area's history.
And I understand a big part of your personal history.
Yes, my dad
as
was,
well.
My dad was one of the miners who died that day. He was 47 years old and he left behind 8 children. Some with were very young. The youngest was 4 years old at the time, and the oldest was about 19.
So this project obviously has a lot of personal meaning to you. Tell us where this project is at right now. I understand you've got some estimates, and there's been a design you've been looking at as well.
Yes. The Miners Museum have expressed interest in this project a few times over the past 2 years, and Mary Pat Mombriquet and I have had some discussions. And recently, with the 40th anniversary occurring almost a month ago, we got to talking that we need to stop just talking about it and take some action. So there is a GoFundMe project campaign presently taking place through Facebook. And our original goal was $5,000. We surpassed that on this weekend, mostly due to a very generous donation from the Steelworkers Union. And we've increased the goal for that at this time to $10,000. So we went out to Steele's Monument in North Sydney today, and we received an estimate for them in the ballpark figure of $30,000 for a monument and some benches and the foundation in to put the monument on. So now we have an idea of how much money we need to raise and how much money we can approach the government for to see if they can contribute a portion of what's needed.
Okay. Now, how are your discussions going with the government? Have the representatives you've approached been receptive to the idea? Or
2 years ago, I wasn't getting a lot of reception from the few people that I contacted. It was I would be recommended to go to this person, and then that person would send me to someone else, and just kind of I felt like I was chasing my tail. So now that we are in the process of forming a committee, we will be contacting some government officials. And I do believe that there have been some emails sent to Jeff McClellan and Roger Kuzner in the past week or two from some of our committee members.
So if you're making the pitch to anyone from government who might be listening, what would you say to them?
We're in the early stages of fundraising, and the amount that's going to be needed is about $30,000, and it would be really nice if government representatives could match what we're raising to help us get this project off the ground.
So you're looking for cost-shared funding from all three levels
exactly.
of government?
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
And I think with the history of Glace Bay's mining, this town was built on the backs of coal miners, and Cape Breton Island, with its coal mining industry for many years, generated a good amount of revenue for the province of Nova Scotia for many years. And I think it's time that a little bit of that was paid back to the families of these miners in the aspect of putting a monument in place for these families to remember their loved ones.
And it certainly wouldn't be at a place. I mean, I come from New Waterford, where there's a monument to the 1917
exactly.
disaster. So it would be sort of in keeping with a lot of the other things that have been done elsewhere, right?
Yes. Yes, I agree. And there's one in Westway, in Glasgow, for the Westway explosion that took place in 1992. And I think it's only fitting that Glace Bay has something to remember theirs.
So can you say anything about the design you're looking at now, or like what's it actually going to look like, or what do you want it to look like?
From the discussion that we had at Steele's Monument this morning, it's going to be approximately a 5-foot-wide monument and a low-standing monument, not very high, because it's going to be in close proximity to the Atlantic Ocean, given its location at the Miners Museum. So we want something that's not going to be susceptible to the high winds.
So this would be like out back at the Miners Museum?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. And made of what kind of material?
Granite.
It's granite? Okay.
Granite.
And I assume the names will be engraved?
The names will be engraved on it. The names and the age of the miners at the time of their death. And also on a section below that, there will be the names of the 4 surviving miners from that explosion.
Any sculpture to go with it?
There will be a sketch of the number 26 colliery on top of the monument.
You are looking at a timeline of sometime this summer, is that right?
That's what we're hoping for. We set a soft target this morning of perhaps Labor Day to have the monument installed. We have some fundraising ideas that we're discussing at our next meeting on Monday. And we hope to have a formal committee formed at our next few meetings also to formally set out our proposal to government levels.
What other kinds of fundraising are you considering? I know there's the GoFundMe page, and there's been some requests to government. What other ideas do you have?
Mary Pat Mombriquet is working on a proposal through the UMWA. I don't really want to speak more about that until she's had a chance to address it. And we're also looking into some local organizations to see if they could partner with us to do some fundraising in addition to the GoFundMe. I believe, under the name of the 1979 Miners Explosion. It's being shared quite a bit on Facebook. And if you are reluctant to make a donation in that way, you can make a donation at the Miners Museum and specify that it's for the Miners Monument, and Mary Pat Mombriquet can issue you a tax receipt for that donation.
Joanne Shepherd, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Dave.
And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca.